open an informational meeting of the House Land Use Committee on Tuesday, January 27th, 2009. Colleagues, we have three different pieces of our agenda today. Invited testimony to continue the critical background information that we have leading up to a little later in today's meeting. I will open our first public hearing on House Bill 2229. I want to emphasize that it will be our first public hearing, and while we are having just invited testimony today on that bill from the task force members who have developed the bill, we will have at least two additional public hearings for this committee to hear general testimony from the public on that bill. So we will have plenty of opportunity for members of the public to weigh in on that proposed legislation. In fact, colleagues, we will probably want to have at least one of those meetings, an evening meeting, to give the public who has a difficult time being here during the day an opportunity to weigh in. So the staff will be in touch with your offices about scheduling that, but I think that's an appropriate way for us to be accessible to the public. I also want to call your attention. Has this been distributed?
It was.
Okay. You may recall that at our last meeting, Mr. Jim Labby gave testimony, and in response to a question that I believe Representative Greenlick asked, he has provided the follow-up information that was addressed during that meeting. And I just wanted to put it on the record that we have received that, and it will be part of our committee public record. You all should have it electronically in your offices. So after that housekeeping business, I will go immediately to an informational meeting, as I said. Dr. Cy Adler is here with us. He is a professor at Portland State's Toulon School of Urban Studies and Planning, and is currently completing research on the early stages of the land use planning system in Oregon, and has agreed to come today to give us a brief overview of setting the stage for what the land use planning program was designed to address, the kinds of political, economic environment that was there, so that then as we look at the report from the task force, we have that for context. Professor Adler?
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cy Adler. I have been a professor of urban studies and planning at Portland State University since 1982. For the past 2 years, as the chair mentioned, I've been studying the early history of the land use planning program, and I've made it through 1975. So I'm going to say a few words today about the key laws passed during 1969-1973, discuss some aspects of the goal development process in 1974, and highlight the significance of what happened to the proposed LCDC budget and work program during the 1975 session. So here's my story. Land use-related problems emerged during the 1960s in Oregon and throughout the United States and Canada. The four key problems here were, one, loss of productive farmland to sprawling land development, especially in the Willamette Valley. Two, pollution-related problems, often due to failing septic tanks and the absence of adequate infrastructure to accommodate growth, especially on the coast. Three, fraudulent land sales practices and problematic land subdivision practices were occurring in southern, central, and eastern Oregon. And four, lack of coordination between the infrastructure projects of state agencies, special districts, and public utilities on the one hand, and local government plans and economic development efforts on the other. All of the above were seen by those concerned as threats to vital state interests in the health of key economic sectors and as causes of increasing costs to state and local governments to provide facilities and services. A growing number of state political and administrative officials, as well as citizen activists and business leaders, were persuaded that most local governments, especially county governments, were either unwilling or unable to address those problems. Local planning commissions, where they existed, and local elected officials were seen as prone to capture by property owners and developers interested primarily in short-term economic gains, gains that came at the expense of vital long-term state interests and environmental health. Local governments competing with one another within and between metropolitan areas were seen as having an interest in virtually any and all development that might increase the value of property in their jurisdictions. A new structure of intergovernmental relationships regarding land use issues was seen by reformers as required to counterbalance the short-term development-oriented local government perspective. Growing environmental awareness in Oregon and elsewhere had produced legislative breakthroughs regarding air and water quality. Land use was next. Efforts to create a new intergovernmental structure, though, engendered intense conflicts. Those conflicts centered on the nature and extent of discretion available to the various governmental participants in land use plan making and implementation processes. Conflicts over how much specificity ought to be written into statutes and later on goals were key features of debates during both legislative and administrative processes. Senate Bill 10 in 1969 set Oregon on a path to addressing those land use related concerns. The sprawl-related farmland preservation problem motivated the Senate Agriculture Committee to sponsor the bill. The law included a mandate that all local governments adopt comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances by the end of 1971. The governor's office was authorized to take over planning and zoning responsibilities when a local government proved either unwilling or unable to fulfill the mandate. A set of 10 statewide planning goals, written at the request of a legislative committee by leading members of the professional planning community, Arnold Kogan among them, was incorporated into Senate Bill 10 to guide the governor's office if and when it chose to take over. Reflecting a growing level of environmental awareness among planners, a carrying capacity goal was included. Governor McCaul used typically colorful language to introduce the bill. He talked about, quote, an urban explosion of environmental pollution threatening the livability of Oregon, and the scatteration of unimaginative, mislocated urban development, introducing little cancerous cells of unmentionable ugliness into our rural landscape, whose cumulative effect threatened to turn this state of scenic excitement into a land of aesthetic boredom. He thought that Senate Bill 10 would cleanse the notions of planning and zoning, especially since it was the generally conservative Senate Agriculture Committee that championed it. Those wouldn't any longer be dirty words. Senate Bill 10 was an unfunded mandate, though, and a state agency wasn't created to oversee local governments and to coordinate their efforts. In some counties, the cleansing process went only skin deep. In other counties, it didn't penetrate at all. 28% of Oregon counties and 34% of the cities adopted plans and zoning ordinances by the deadline. The governor didn't step in, although he probably would have if the legislature had given him some money to do so. During the early 1970s, the problems mentioned above were increasingly in evidence. Hector McPherson, a county planning commissioner elected to the Senate in 1971, was disappointed both with the limited response to the Senate Bill 10 mandate and with the effectiveness of the work done by many of the counties that did comply. He saw a need for statewide standards to elevate the quality of what local governments were doing and to give their efforts some teeth. McPherson wanted state Senate support for an interim committee in 1972 to study new land use legislation, but he didn't get it. He turned for help to environmental activists, especially members of the Oregon Environmental Council, with whom he had worked closely during the 71 session, and to the Local Government Relations Division in the governor's office. The original version of Senate Bill 10, crafted by McPherson and his advisors, contained a great deal of specificity. It represented the high point of efforts to create a dramatically different structure of intergovernmental relations in the land use field. Both the governor's office and the environmentalists supported a new state land use agency that would play an authoritative role in relation to other state agencies and local governments. The governor's office also advocated on behalf of an important role for regional agencies, councils of government. They would work closely with state agencies to prepare plans that would coordinate local government planning efforts. The environmentalists strongly advocated on behalf of incorporating into a new law specific areas of critical statewide concern, primarily sensitive environmental areas, and activities of statewide significance, such as transportation, water, sewerage, solid waste disposal, energy facilities, and public schools. The new state agency would be authorized to implement required permitting processes for the listed activities and to develop regulations for critical areas that local governments would be required to implement. In addition, the new state agency was mandated to articulate the state's vital land use related interests via a set of statewide planning goals. The 10 goals set out in Senate Bill 10 were incorporated into Senate Bill 100 on an interim basis until the new state agency adopted its own. Regional and local plans and state agency land use related programs would have to comply with those goals. McPherson believed deeply in the philosophical reorientation that was taking place in many parts of the country regarding the status of land, away from a simple commodity and toward a resource that ought to be managed in the public interest, a stewardship notion. The new structure of intergovernmental relations set out in the original version of SB 100 and in the other bills that were part of the governor's package during the 1973 legislative session was intended to facilitate that transition. In addition to Senate Bill 100, the rest of the package included Senate Bill 101, which expressed the state's interest in agricultural land, bills that regulated the occupational composition of city and county planning commissions that were intended to reduce the likelihood of capture, a bill requiring local governments to develop more rigorous subdivision regulations, and a Land Consumer Protection Act. The version of Senate Bill 100 that passed the legislature, though, eliminated some of the specificity in the original version and delegated the fate of what remained to the new state agency. A specified role for councils of government was eliminated, and counties were given the coordinating role within their jurisdictions. Most cities, especially Portland, were greatly distressed that a coordination role was assigned to the counties. The designation of specific critical areas of statewide concern was taken out of the bill. The new state agency was directed instead to take them into account when it developed goals and was authorized to recommend the designation of critical areas to the legislature. The approach to activities of statewide significance was changed as well. A permit program for them wasn't any longer mandated in the law. The new state agency was authorized to designate one or more of a list of specified activities, though, and to design a permitting process for them. The revised version greatly upset environmental activists, given their theory of local government behavior, the loss of the specific designations of areas of critical statewide concern and activities of statewide significance, threatened to undermine the capacity of a new state agency to play the role they wanted to assign it. Governor McCaul and the Senate Bill 100 co-sponsors, Senators McPherson and Halleck, were disappointed to lose those aspects of the original version as well, but they were pragmatically focused on getting something passed. Senators McPherson and Halleck also agreed to eliminate the emergency clause from the bill to increase its chances of passage in the Senate. As a result, a budget for the new agency was taken off the table, pending the outcome of a possible referral to the electorate. The land use planning program was still then an unfunded mandate. Finally, the Senate committee wrote into the Senate Journal a stipulation that differentiated between goals and guidelines. Goals would carry the force of law, guidelines would not. That distinction would significantly influence the process of developing the statewide goals. Senate Bill 100 and the rest of the governor's package set a complex process in motion. There were few specific standards in the law, though, to structure the goal development, plan making, and implementation processes that it was about to initiate. A brief comparative perspective. Hawaii and British Columbia created new roles for the state government, primarily related to the preservation of farmland, as in Oregon. In those cases, a state agency adopted agricultural zoning on an interim basis and then on a permanent basis before any planning was done. Vermont and Florida, the other two states adopting new state-level initiatives about that time, also established permit approaches in advance of plans. The Oregon approach will result in continuing efforts to shape statewide goals and tremendous pressure on local-level planning processes. There will be a great deal of scrutiny of those local government plans because once they are acknowledged, it will be difficult to change them and the ways they are implemented. During the goal development process, the key issues were how detailed and specific goals ought to be, especially in light of the distinction between goals and guidelines, and when conflicts between goals are identified, as many definitely were during 1974, were there going to be any explicit priorities regarding how to resolve them, and if there were, who would establish those priorities? Many of the same land use related debates that characterized the 73 legislative session resurfaced during goal development. One difference was that in 1974, land use planning and environmental advocates were worried about a severely underfunded new state agency getting captured by those whose behavior the agency was intended to change. They wanted fact-based, detailed, specific goals and explicit conflict resolution mechanisms for two reasons, one political and the other legal. Politically, they hoped that such an approach would prevent capture of the new state agency by local governments and their industry group supporters. And they also hoped to prevent capture of local government planning processes by property developers and by homeowners interested in exclusion. Legally, they thought that fact-based specific standards were more likely to be acceptable to the courts, a critical point stressed by the attorneys among the advocates. Local governments and their industry group supporters wanted to see goals stated in general terms, which would permit them the autonomy to make on-balance judgments about what was important for their jurisdictions. They wanted to exercise the discretion to resolve goal conflicts as they saw fit. LCDC decided in October 1974 that the Senate Bill 10 goals should be the basis for the goals the Commission would adopt. One intense debate developed around the conflict between the goal to preserve farmland and the goal to contain sprawl about the relationship between constraints on the supply of land for residential development and the availability of affordable housing. That discussion led to the emergence of a housing goal containing some explicit language to prevent exclusionary practices, which wasn't one of the SB 10 goals then under consideration. Another intense debate focused on the process of deciding how and where to draw urban growth boundaries and what should happen inside and outside those lines. Local governments wanted to make those judgments with a minimum of direction from the state. Environmental advocates, especially the attorneys and planners among them, wanted specific directions regarding how they ought to be drawn, incorporated into the urbanization goal, and also wanted an explicit farmland preservation priority articulated. Led by key LCDC members and supported by Hector McPherson, they advocated strongly for the use of an objective measure, soil classifications provided by independent experts, to determine farmland-related zoning choices outside the boundaries. Those were incorporated into the agricultural lands goal. They also strongly supported an urban lands goal that would include explicit standards to produce denser, more compact, mixed-use patterns of development inside the lines. Those specific measures weren't adopted in 1974. Overall, with the exception of the agricultural lands goal and the partial exception of the urbanization goal, there wasn't a great deal of specificity and explicit conflict resolution mechanisms built into the goals that LCDC adopted at the end of 1974. Local governments would still get to exert a substantial amount of discretion. A carrying capacity goal, which was one of those in Senate Bill 10, surfaced and generated a great deal of controversy, but was dropped late in the process, as was a shorelands goal. LCDC decided not to designate any activities of statewide significance. Other state agencies generally opposed the idea, as did industry groups. The commission agreed, though, to recommend to the legislature the designation of two areas of critical statewide concern, one of which had especially strong gubernatorial support. Following goal adoption, LCDC developed a proposed budget request and related work program for the 1975-77 biennium. The agency proposed to undertake many projects that it hoped to do during the 73-75 biennium, but was unable to undertake because of severe funding constraints. Given the goal development experience, LCDC wanted to do a set of regionalized carrying capacity studies that would permit it to refine its adopted goals on a regional basis and lead to a new carrying capacity goal and guidelines. During the first round of workshops in 1974 and throughout the goal development period, LCDC heard support for regionalizing goals. The agency wanted to respond. It wanted to develop also a one-stop permit process that would address concerns about the time-related cost of getting development proposals approved. LCDC wanted to work on recommendations for additional areas of critical statewide concern and on a regulatory program for the two it had already decided to recommend. The agency also wanted to get busy designating activities of statewide significance and designing permit programs for them. A major portion of its budget request was for money to transform the local government planning and zoning mandates into a funded program and for the agency to gear up to evaluate what the locals would produce. LCDC also suggested new legislation, including a bill that would enable local governments to implement transfer of development rights programs, a bill to authorize the development of a state growth policy, something that LCDC thought was important to guide state agency and local government investment plans, and a bill to mandate changes in county tax assessor practices that would enhance the effectiveness of the exclusive farm use zoning approach to preserving agricultural land. Only the tax assessment bill passed during the 1975 session. Governor Straub's office agreed with the total amount of money requested by LCDC. The governor's willingness to support a substantial budget for the land use program during a very difficult financial time for the state was critically important to its survival. The governor's budget recommended, though, shifting a substantial portion of the money LCDC wanted to use to increase its own capacity to the local government grant program. In addition, the governor told LCDC that it didn't want any new money to be used to do carrying capacity studies, and he didn't want LCDC to play a lead role in developing a one-stop permit process, although he liked the idea. The legislature continued the process of cutting the agency's share of money for its own initiatives and reallocating it to support local government planning. While the budget that emerged from the 1975 legislature represented a major increase from what the agency had gotten earlier, and it was clear that the governor and the legislature were now willing to fund the local government mandate to plan and zone, the LCD wouldn't be able to do much more than oversee the grants it would allocate to local governments and react to what the locals did in response to the adopted goals. It would play a largely reactive role. That concludes my presentation, and I would be pleased to try to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Professor. Are there any questions for Professor Adler? Representative Clem.
Just out of curiosity, what were the two area of critical concerns that were nominated?
The Metolius Deer Winter Range and the Columbia River Gorge.
Thank you.
Now, during the 1974 goal development process, when the Metolius Deer Winter Range was proposed for study, state agencies said they didn't think that was an especially good idea because there were many deer winter ranges that were equally as important as the Metolius. And following that testimony and the testimony of others of a similar nature, LCDC actually took it off the list. But during the final public hearing, both Governor McCaul and Governor-elect Straub said they really thought the Metolius required critical area status. And so LCDC put it back.
Can I follow up just for a moment?
Yes, please.
Is there some documentation of that particular, that last portion that you have access to in your archives? I mean, I can find another way probably, but...
The places where I've seen it discussed are in newspaper stories. You know, I've looked through the LCDC minutes, and there isn't a lot in the minutes that refer specifically to those decisions. But newspaper coverage of the statewide goal adoption that LCDC did in late December 74 mentioned those two critical area decisions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Professor Adler? Yes, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much. Hi, Cy. Thanks for coming. It's a follow-up of Representative Clem's question. Can you talk about this area of critical state concern in terms of its current context? I have a bill that proposes naming Forest Park and the areas around it an area of critical state concern, and nobody seems to know what I'm talking about. That isn't the only topic that's true of, I have to say.
Well, I'm sorry I can't talk about it in its current context. I can give you a little more historical detail about the notion if that would be helpful.
Small amount would be helpful.
Tiny little bit. The McPherson Committee working on SB 100 drew very heavily on two sources, two books that had been published when it was doing its work. One was a model land development code that was under development by the American Law Institute, a branch of the American Bar Association. The Model Land Development Code is the source for the ideas about new roles for the state government and critical areas of concern, activities of statewide significance, were key recommendations made by the American Law Institute in the Model Land Development Code. And so Hector McPherson and his group picked up on those notions. And again, they were critically important to him and to environmental activists who saw in them a method to get the state playing a very important role in protecting sensitive environmental areas.
Thank you.
It is my expectation, colleagues, that over the course of the deliberations of this committee, we will all make ourselves quite familiar with the term area of critical concern. We have other legislation in our possession that may prompt those conversations. So, Professor, you may have an opportunity to come educate us all a little more at another date.
My pleasure.
Thank you for being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The next panel presents the findings of work that the Big Look Task Force and LCDC engage to help them complete one of their tasks that the legislature assigned to the task force under Senate Bill 82, which was to assess how effective the land use planning program has been at achieving its goals. To help the task force and LCDC make that assessment, they engaged the Institute for Natural Resources to conduct a review and evaluation of the program, and I would like to invite the authors of that report to come forward and present their findings to us. Ms. Gail Achterman is the director of the Institute, and she has three colleagues who conducted the study. Ms. Achterman, I think, will introduce the panel.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. It's a pleasure to be here today. Gail Achterman, Director of the Institute for Natural Resources, which was one of the Oregon University System's multi-campus interdisciplinary research institutes. We were established by the legislature in 2000 in order to provide the legislature one place to go to tap into the expertise of the Oregon University System and its faculty. I think the evaluation that we were able to do on the Oregon Land Use Planning planning system in conjunction with the Institute for Metropolitan Studies at Portland State University really embodies the kind of assistance that we in the university system are really pleased to be able to provide to all of you. It was great when you, Chair Nolan, approached us and when the legislature funded us in 2000, or funded DLCD and the Big Look Task Force so that we could undertake this evaluation. I'd like to introduce my colleagues. I think it's a statement in itself that the faculty participating in this evaluation and analysis were from Oregon State University, Portland State University, the University of Oregon, and we're particularly pleased that Dr. Jeffrey Klein from the Forest Science Laboratory of the U.S. Forest Service was able to participate as well. So today, Dr. Lisa Gaines, Associate Director of the Institute for Natural Resources, who managed the project, Dr. Ellen Bassett from Portland State University, Dr. Adler also from Portland State participated but isn't presenting on the panel, and Dr. Klein will all proceed to give you the highlights from the full report, which I understand has been provided to your committee.
And we appreciate your all being here. We do have the executive summary. I think everyone has reviewed that and have access to the full report. We also do have the co-chairs of the task force waiting to present their bill, so
we'll be quick.
Thank you. Doctors?
We do have a PowerPoint presentation. Thank you for having
Excellent.
Us here.
Thank you.
And so I don't know, I have it on my screen here of your laptop, but I don't know how it's getting projected.
He is going to project it.
Mr. Hoyt?
Well, our task was assigned to look at five of the goals of the land use planning system, particularly Goal 1, Goal 3, Goal 4, Goal 14, and Goal 16. We had teams of many working on this, and we were asked to do a couple of things: to assess the goal as it is written, currently written, and to look at academic theory that might help us lead to some sort of assessment of the goal. Of our team, we have two of our faculty members that participated. Ellen will be presenting Goal 1 and 4. I'm sorry, 1 and 14, and Jeff will be presenting Goal 3 and 4. Overall, we found the system to be sound, particularly with the goals that we had evaluated. And in particular, and as expected, there were changes or differences across the goals when it came to data needs of how we'd ultimately maybe create a system to evaluate the land use planning program. What I will do is I will forward things as you need them.
I'm going to briefly speak about citizen involvement, Goal 1, as well as Goal 14. And I won't read it to you because I know you can read. But basically, Goal 1 really reflects the sort of sense we all have that good planning is premised on citizen participation, and that when people participate, it should be the full range of citizens across all planning processes. So interestingly, in trying to do a literature review on this goal, compared to other things that have been written about the Oregon planning system, Goal 1 is under-researched. So there's very little academic secondary literature on the planning on Goal 1. What does exist is primarily descriptive. So it talks about the role of LCDC, talks about the role of SEAC, the local level citizen involvement committees. So as a result of that, we had to do something called an institutional review. So we went to the archives at DLCD, looked at the initial plans as to what we were going to do around citizen participation, interviewed key actors, some of whom have spoken in front of you already, and then we conducted what I can only call an opportunistic survey of planning directors. We had their emails. And so what were our findings? Interestingly, despite the importance of, and we interpreted Goal 1 as a ranked goal, so this is a baseline, very important goal, despite the importance of it and support for citizen involvement, when you talk to people who were there at the beginning, in particular the informational interviews that we did with some of the people who have the big picture on what happened in the Oregon Land Use Planning System, performance on this goal, they feel, has fallen short of initial aspirations. We have a really innovative program, but when you start to look at what's happening with citizen participation, we have, in fact, for the most part, moved from trying to innovate in the initial plans to having the most common way of citizen participation in most of our localities, which is the Planning Commission. Is this good? Is this bad? We can't tell, but that is the change that has taken place. The second major consensus that emerged from the research that we did is the observation that while Goal 1 has increased opportunities for participation, so basically quantities of events that you can go to, this is not the same as enhancing participation in terms of quality. So are people participating in a fuller way? In particular, a series of observations that is we have high levels of participation at the most contentious junctures, so when we are fighting over land use decisions. And this allows for the least dialogue. So that's one of the problems that was pointed out in terms of the system. In terms of data needs and gaps, there's a huge gap. There's very little, actually, original data that's reported by localities, for instance, on how they're approaching citizen participation, how many people participate. And there are ways that, if that is of interest, it can certainly be addressed. What we did suggest in the report is that perhaps state and local governments should come together to develop some sort of a programmatic evaluation process to look at our citizen participation in both short-term and long-term planning processes, and that, in fact, you'd have different metrics for those different types of processes. So, you know, clearly it's easy enough to call quantity, number of meetings, but trying to figure out quality, the value of the participation, the impacts, how it was utilized, that's a much more difficult thing to gauge. So that was goal one. Mm-hmm. Goal 14. This is probably, okay, everybody knows this is the urbanization goal, the goal that, for the most part, introduced the UGB and thought about how do we use the UGB around our major urban areas to create quality livable communities and to manage the transition of land use from urban land uses to, or actually the other way, from rural land uses into urbanization. In contrast with goal one, there's a lot written about the UGB in the academic literature that's out there. It's very large. And it's very challenging to research this for a number of reasons, which are detailed in the report. But let me highlight the findings of this big literature that we looked at. If we're looking for specific criteria to measure whether the UGB is functioning or not, one criterion that's often used is urban form. Are we creating more compact, more dense communities? That's one of the outputs that was looked at. Measuring just by population densities, most of the studies that we reviewed saw positive impacts from the UGB, or UGBs. Another potential impact from the urban growth boundaries that has been studied in the literature is what would be the impact of UGBs upon service delivery costs and tax burdens. So again, the idea is if you're creating a more dense urban form, you allow for more efficient infrastructure provision of urban services such as water, that kind of thing. This is really understudied for Oregon localities, and so there's a couple pieces of literature out there that we looked at, but it's really hard to say with any specificity for Oregon that this is the case. However, there are a lot of other studies that have shown positive relationships between compact urban forms, which we are seeing in Oregon, and these sort of outcomes. The third highlight I have there is basically the issue of land markets. Again, by drawing a line, we have, in fact, had the impact that we've anticipated both in sort of the theoretical as well as the policy outcomes, that you are creating different land markets. You're creating a rural land market as well as an urban land market. There's a very interesting study that actually shows, you know, if you look at the land market in Portland, for instance, there's an interesting amenity effect at the boundaries of those. Perhaps most contentiously is the question of housing prices. Looking in the literature that we looked at, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not the UGB has negative impacts or positive in terms of making housing prices rise upon housing price increases. Looking at the literature there, it's not been clearly associated with housing price increases. There's a couple things that are going on there. For one thing, the UGB should have a 20-year land supply so that you have this mitigating factor that you actually have available green space land that could counteract this land scarcity that would be passed on into a housing price. The second thing is that's been happening, especially in the studies on Portland, is that development patterns matter. So you can draw your line with your UGB, but if in the same time you've got policies within the UGB that are increasing housing density, you aren't going to see housing prices go up the same way you would if you had a lower density zoning, for instance. So it's a fairly complex, there's a lot that's been written on this, there's some that's been written on this subject. Some other small impacts just to highlight, initial research on walking and biking. The UGB, at least in the Portland area, is strongly associated with increased walking and biking behavior because we are apparently less automobile friendly and people are doing modal shifts and moving to different types of transportation. Another impact that was shown in the literature is that strong urban containment, as has been practiced in Oregon localities or in the Oregon system, has been shown to reduce residential segregation by race. So we're quite different from some of the paired cities that we were studied with there. And then finally, just in terms of urban containment, one of the reasons for not wanting urban sprawl is the decentralization and decline of your central city. And one thing that has been shown through the studies, since in fact, is that urban containment and has been shown to have a positive impact in economic performance using a variety of measures, so jobs, commercial floor space, the capture of economic growth in the UGB, or sorry, in the CBD, the downtown. Data needs and gaps. There's very few here that to really talk about. One thing that most people are doing studies on, they're looking at federal census data, they're looking at NRI, National Resources Inventory data, which I'm sure you'll talk about. You could do different types of studies if there was available local-level GIS parcel-based data, which I know has been discussed as a potential for the, for DLCD as a role. So that's it for the 414.
Hi, my name is Jeff Klein. I'm with the USDA Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station. I've been a research forester down there for about 12 years, and I'm an economist by training, and my specialty is land use research. Before I begin my discussion of forest lands, I was asked to briefly summarize the work of Hannah Gusnell regarding agricultural lands. Whether we're talking about ag lands or forest lands, a difficulty in evaluating the effect of planning on land conservation is measuring how much development would have happened without planning. Analysts have often looked for evidence of planning effects by comparing development across states that do or do not have planning, or by looking at changes in development trends over time, both before and after planning implementation. Analysts might also use more sophisticated empirical modeling techniques to simulate development in a world without planning. The collection of studies that both Hannah and I examined include all of these types of studies, with each individual study offering a different weight of evidence about the effectiveness of Oregon's planning program at meeting the goals regarding forest and agricultural lands. Taken in combination, Hannah has concluded that there is a general consensus in research literature that Oregon's planning program has helped to reduce the loss of agricultural lands to development. However, there is little evidence one way or the other in research literature indicating whether these conservation effects have concentrated on high-quality or prime agricultural lands owing to a general lack of data and analysis on the issue. So we've preserved ag lands, but we don't know really what the characteristics of those ag lands are that we've preserved. Early in the life of Oregon's planning program, there was a concern about hobby farming, and several studies showed that to be a problem in the 1980s. But despite strong concern about that in the 1980s, subsequent reexamination of hobby farming has not occurred since the early 1990s to follow up on that issue. There's also evidence that dwelling approvals in exclusive farm use zones have decreased since 1994. But also, there is little evidence one way or the other in research literature regarding whether dwellings located on farm-use zoned lands actually adversely impact agriculture. Again, mostly just because it hasn't been something that's been studied in Oregon. Now, each of our reports features several observations and recommendations regarding data and analytical gaps. And I saved this particular slide because it features Hannah's observations and recommendations regarding research focused on ag lands. I only retained these in case we want to return to these themes, and so I'm not going to really go through these in detail. The focus of my work has been on the forest land conservation effects of planning, and it's actually some of the focus of my own research at the Forest Service. Similar to the situation with agricultural lands is the difficulty in measuring how much forest land development would happen without planning. Now, the collection of studies that I examined included a variety of analytical techniques that I've mentioned, and a lot of overlap with the studies examined by Hannah in her work regarding agricultural lands. A key observation from the outset was that forest lands, by virtue of their relative geographic isolation from existing urban areas and their generally steeper topography, likely would have experienced less development pressure than ag lands with or without planning. So forest lands are just not facing, just in general, are not going to face the level of development pressure that agricultural lands are, especially when you think of the topography in the Willamette Valley and the location of the cities there. I feel that these characteristics tend to lead to study conclusions that are less dramatic in terms of the magnitude of conservation effect detected on forest lands relative to corresponding conclusions about the conservation effects found on agricultural lands. Taken together, studies that address the forest land conservation effects of Oregon's land use planning program support the conclusion that planning has had a measurable effect at reducing the loss of forest land to development. However, the magnitude of this effect is relatively small in comparison to the corresponding effects on agricultural lands. There is some evidence in Oregon that development is correlated with reduced management of forest lands for commercial production. From this, we might guess that by reducing forest land development, planning likely helps to maintain commercial forestry activities, though direct evidence of this particular effect is lacking, again, for lack of analysis and data. Lastly, improving on existing studies and continued monitoring and assessment of the planning program depends on maintaining key data resources, the most notable of which are the land use and structure count data gathered by the Oregon Department of Forestry in collaboration with the USDA Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station. Now, as with the report on ag lands, we've made several observations and recommendations regarding data and analytical gaps concerning the forest lands portion, and we can return to these if you want to later. In concluding, I would like to point out that while we can tell you that land use research conducted in Oregon does provide some evidence that Oregon's planning program has resulted in the conservation of forests and agricultural lands, whether the magnitudes of those conservation effects are sufficient to declare the program fully successful in meeting goals 3 and 4 remains open to interpretation. We can only tell you that research literature suggests that the program saved some land from development. We cannot tell you whether or not it saved enough land, and that's for you and the Oregon public to decide.
In short, this was a very time-sensitive and time-limited study. I think we conducted it in about 6 to 8 weeks, and we had an exceptional team of about 15 or 20 people that all participated in this. And as Jeff and Ellen both have mentioned, that it does seem that there is the suggestion that the land use planning program is sound. However, when we looked through our data needs and data gaps, there were some shortfalls, that there are various correlations that were weak or difficult to get at. And in one case, the citizen involvement, there was no data available. We thought of a number of ways and recommendations that are highlighted on the screen, and we do believe that with some sort of a suggested process or structure, we can enhance the planning system characteristics that different stakeholders, including citizens, decision makers, and planners and agencies, have consistently advocated for, those including clarity, flexibility, and accountability. This ends our presentations, and we welcome any questions you might have.
Questions from committee members for any of these researchers? Representative Clem?
Thank you. I forget which doctor I'm referring to. Male, far left. You had mentioned the lack of data on sort of the impacts of residential, when development occurs, how does that end up affecting the operations? Do you think that with the, you know, say next 1 to 4 years, you're going to see, you know, potentially 7,000 to 9,000 new dwellings built under Measure 49? Would that give a data set to then survey they and their neighbors for how that worked out?
Yeah, you could probably do that research now even. I mean, there's places around the country where people look at the impact of dwellings on agricultural operations. It's just that research hasn't been done here, and I'm not sure who would do it, just thinking about the researchers that work with land use issues around Oregon here. I don't know anybody who's working on that right now. But yeah, that would give you another opportunity. If you saw dwellings under Measure 49, it would give you another opportunity to examine that. But you could even do it now by looking at where houses are being built and whether or not they impact the agricultural operation.
Any other questions? Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think for Dr. Bassett, you mentioned the piece on positive impact on economic performance within the urban area, and you said there were more details. Could you, the positive impact to which economy?
Okay. Essentially, there's a series of
Dr.
studies.
Dr. Bassett, excuse me, could you pull the mic so that we can get it on the recording? Thank you.
There's a series of studies that are looking essentially at a couple of different variables, trying to figure out in areas that have a UGB and don't have a UGB, so this with-without kind of thing, looking at whether relative to each other in comparison, does a place with an urban containment system, an urban growth boundary, does it capture key indicators of having economic activity in the center? Economic performance being key indicators like the number of jobs that are located within the UGB, the relative value and location of commercial real estate that's been built, looking at land assessors' values, that kind of thing. That is the series of studies, and basically Portland in particular, relative to other large cities, has maintained a larger capture of 70% of area jobs or something, and don't quote me on that particular figure, compared to like cities that we were compared to.
Can I follow up? So the, one of the questions related to whether you were comparing inside the UGB to outside the UGB,
right,
or now you've clarified city to city.
City to city. So a lot of the studies, in fact, on the UGB, similar to this, the idea of sort of you want to do with, without, there'll be comparative studies that are looking, well, how did Portland do vis-a-vis some comparator cities?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the comparator cities are kind of unusual ones, like Columbus, Ohio, but looking for places that have sort of similar economies that have very different land use systems. And so that's relative for the same of all the sort of things in terms of what our urban form looks like, what some of our delivery costs are, those kind of things.
Okay. And a follow-up question is, was any kind of study done to look at the makeup of families within UGB versus outside, i.e., we continue to see Portland-specific, downtown Portland, less children, less need for schools, all that kind of thing.
Right.
Is that compacting of those folks driving families with children out, or are we just seeing a preference for living with more space with families?
So there's a couple, there's some issues about how do you isolate the UGB as the cause that is a challenge in doing this kind of research. So clearly, I mean, not in what I've reviewed here, but there's definitely studies that are looking at demographic trends.
Mm-hmm.
So the trends that you're talking about, if you know there's with the Equity Atlas in the Portland region, that's talking about the suburbanization of poverty, the changing of household composition, you know, more, you know, dual couples, sort of kid people living in Southeast and that kind of thing. I haven't seen any studies that's trying to associate, I'm trying to think, there's a lot of studies we read for this. with that exact sort of, you know, that's the variable they want to explain. It's been much more the classic ones that I just talked to you about, housing values, density, urban form, those kind of things. So I can write that down and look for you if that would
thank
be helpful.
You.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your presentation, I'm being one from outside the Willamette Valley, appeared to be in the Willamette Valley. Each and every one of you resides in the Willamette Valley. How much of this data have we researched outside the Willamette Valley?
Great question.
You go first, I'll go.
With the focus of the studies that we looked at that focused on forest and agriculture, and most of the studies focused on agriculture because that was the larger interest of the academicians that were working on this, focused on the Willamette Valley in Western Oregon. The limited work that's been done in Eastern Oregon that I'm aware of, focusing on forest and agricultural lands, would be my own work. We have data that we work with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and we gather data on structure counts, which we actually have interns from Willamette University with aerial photos counting buildings on the ground on well-defined circles on the ground, or on the photos. And we track those over time, and then we look for ways to explain the patterns of dwellings on the landscape based on proximity and things. So we build these land use models. And the reason the Forest Service is interested in this is because the ecologists want to know where development is going to happen in the future. So this is what I do much of my time with the Forest Service. And we have data for Eastern Oregon, and it wasn't gathered until about, I'm thinking, 2002 or 2003 when we filled the data in for Eastern Oregon. And the difficulty in studying the impact of the land use law in Eastern Oregon is that, except for a few isolated locations, the amount of land use change out there is fairly limited. You know, you have Bend and, you know, the Bend-Redmond corridor is changing fast. And but other places, even places like LeGrand and stuff, it's hard to see change using this type of data that we have. And it's the only data that we have in Eastern Oregon, is these you know, these structure counts and things like that. And it's even though we collect it at a relatively fine spatial scale, it's hard to see any kind of change happening. Even when we look at the Bend area, you think it's going to be really dramatic, and, gee, it's a big area. And there's not, when you look at it with these data, say, yeah, there's change there, but it's not a lot of change. And to look at the impact of the land use law, you need enough change happening so that you can see a departure from that change. And so you need enough of a trend of change to see, to be able to measure a change in the trend, if you can follow that. And so that's a difficulty in Oregon generally, but especially on the east side. And so I'll, do you want to follow? Yeah.
So that's a no.
I'd say no. I think there's a yes. There is data, but it's very limited.
Okay. Yeah. So, but basically, what you were talking about, all of you, was the Willamette Valley, because that's where the change is, and that's where the big rub is, because that's where your population growth is, that's where your expansion is, and that's where your agricultural lands are within that valley itself. I do want to make one statement about the UGB not clearly associated with housing price increases.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be the UGB, but it may be the policies of the local municipalities. And I'm going to give you two examples. Southern Oregon, we have Ashland and we have Jacksonville. Both of those have not had a large amount of growth. The average home in Ashland sells for about $440,000.
Mm-hmm.
Jacksonville passed them. So they're up over $440,000 now. But they had several moratoriums on sewer and water, which impeded their growth, which in turn had a cause and effect. The unfortunate thing there is, where do their kids go? So there is a cause and effect on what we do with our building in our area.
Okay. What I'm... Would you like to respond, Dr. Bassett, and then we're going to go to our the co-chairs of the task force.
Just two quick points. One, your point on housing prices is really well taken, and it's a complicated thing to study because there's such a suite of things that can affect what a housing price is. And so that's part of, you know, we were supposed to isolate that UGB to the best we could. In terms of the data and the studies all being on the Willamette, in particular, if you look at the studies we reviewed for the urban growth boundary, most of the studies are in Portland. And the reason for that is really data availability, and that you've got some data, very data-rich places, and you have federal data across the country that's comparable. So if you're doing a study across cities, of course, you're going to gravitate to Portland because there's all this data there. And some of the smaller areas, they're much less studied, and the ones that have been studied have primarily been studied with money coming out of the state of Oregon to do specific studies. So the Bend, UGB, Medford, some of the other places.
So, in fact, yes, that's one of the issues.
Yes.
The legislature hasn't in the past been interested in funding studies to really evaluate, to do the kind of auditing that this program is well. And it's not unique to this agency. It's not unique to this program. But we have not provided the support to do this, the kinds of studies. And a lot of these studies are funded by other entities, not by the state. So it raises issues around that you've identified for us, data needs. Thank you very much, both for the report you've done for us and for this presentation of your findings. I think it's very helpful for the committee.
Thank
and
you.
We will probably be in touch with you as we drill down into this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, colleagues, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2229, and I'd like to invite the co-chairs of the task force that has been diligently looking at how we might modernize and update our land use planning program and preserve its best assets and perhaps improve the ones that are not working as well as we would like it to. And I'll hand it over to you. Commissioner Witte, are you starting? Senator Thorne?
Madam Chair, did you want us to go over our process or our final report, or were you thinking we would start on the bill? We thought Richard Whitman was going to do the bill Thursday.
We'll
do whatever you want.
I would expect that the committee is most interested in the recommendations that you have made. I believe we're all familiar with the process that you undertook and the extensive public input, the 34 some odd meetings that you had. Those are clearly on our record, but we think only you as members of the task force can really put some muscle behind your recommendations, and that's what we'd like to hear.
Do you want to start?
I'll be happy to start. First of all, a bit of formal introduction. I'm Mike Thorne, and along with Nikki Quitty, served as the chairs of the task force. With us today is Ken Bailey, who was also a member of the task force, and so you, for your time, you have three of us rather than two. Officially, I reside in Pendleton, 80685 Highway 37, for the record. Madam Chair and members, I understand that your task force has received a copy of the report, and so I believe our intentions here are going to try to stay at a fairly high level to try to focus on what we think the conclusions or principles were that we discovered as a part of our work, and then invite any kind of questions that you might have and be happy to try to respond to them as best we can. And then, as we understand, on Thursday, Richard Whitman will be available for the task force to spend more time dealing with the specific sections of the bill. I might mention those, but we don't intend to go into those in any detail today. So that's what we're going to
Works great.
Try to do. First of all, I'll start by just reminding us all that the task force was created by the legislature, as you know, in 2005, and there were three questions, primary questions, that you asked us to look at. One was the effectiveness of Oregon's land use planning program in meeting the current and future needs of all parts of the state, respective roles and responsibility of state and local governments in land use planning, in other words, the interface of the two. And then specifically ask us to look at land use issues inside and outside of the urban growth boundaries or urban growth areas. So that was the task we set up on to accomplish. We learned quickly in our effort that in approximately the next 25 years, the Oregon population is going to grow, or there'll be about another 1.7 million, up to maybe 2 million more residents come to the state of Oregon. In addition to that, that is against the backdrop of growing concern regarding concerns relative to climate change, citizens' views with regard to property rights, and more interestingly, the fact that that population growth will not be spread universally across the state of Oregon. In fact, we had reason to believe that that growth will concentrate in five or six areas, possibly some concentrated area in central Oregon, southern Oregon, but the counties primarily in the metropolitan area will be the area that we expect that growth will take place, which then leads us to conclude there will be some parts of the state that will be impacted very little by the changes that additional people might bring. After several, in fact, we were at this for about 3 years, but we had an interruption at your request, and so there was a before and after measure for 49. But there were some conclusions that I think drive the legislative package and some of the outcomes that we're suggesting. One conclusion is that one size doesn't fit all. We kept coming up against that in conversations around the state. Another conclusion that we've clearly came to was that the state should foster greater regional cooperation, that with the growing pressures, many of the solutions that we all seek may well be at a regional level or at a local level, and we need to do whatever we can to encourage that kind of participation and cooperation to help deal with Oregon's Land Use Planning Act. We also reached the conclusion that the state should coordinate planning for land use, economic development, and transportation. Said differently, that leads to a suggestion in our proposal about a strategic plan. And we think as the issues become more complex, a plan that has some forward vision to it will be critical in your ability to plan for the population growth that we see. And finally, there is a perception, and not only a perception, but I think it's real, that there is complexity that's in our system that somehow or another we've got to try to work our way out, and we have a specific suggestion with regard to that. Finally, I would say that the recommendation is not an overhaul of the current system, but we're trying to suggest some strategic adjustments that we think will improve the program. So that led us then to basically five fundamental legislative recommendations. The first is a recommendation that deals with the 19 planning goals. After considerable input, we concluded that we really needed to move to a more strategic kind of view of what we wanted to accomplish. And this will help us give, it should provide a tool in terms of trying to measure some outcomes. In other words, are you getting what you said you wanted to get with whatever you're trying to do? And so those four overarching principles that don't replace the guidelines but clearly should be a standard that we try to measure and look at in terms of trying to reconcile whether we're accomplishing what we say we are. Number one is to provide a healthy environment. Number two, not necessarily in priority, just the four, sustain a prosperous economy, ensure a desirable quality of life, and provide fairness and equity to all Oregonians. We heard those themes time and time again, and so we in the bill, and Mr. Whitman will talk about that in detail on Thursday, included that, and one of the questions that surfaced was, well, does that have a legal standing? And we've tried to reference that in such a way that it should not lead to a lot of litigation with regard to how it applies, but rather give a tool to determine outcomes. And so you'll have more on that later. Foster regional planning. I mentioned that earlier, but we believe that's really a key in terms of our ability to move forward. We've got to find ways to get more efficient and more effective use of shared goals and principles at the local level as a way of helping us do a good job in carrying out the program. We also recommend in one of the sections of the bill, fact three of them, I believe, that counties should develop regional criteria for the designation of farm and forest lands. I think it's probably fair to say, and I'll get to that in a minute, but the issue around farm and forest lands is very sensitive, and there's got to be a way of dealing with some of the pressure and provide actually some relief for that. And so the task force has specific legislation that relates to how counties might begin to develop a regional criteria with regard to farm and forest land. I mentioned complexity. We believe, and you can read in the bill, and we'll mention that in a minute, we've got to find a way to begin to reduce some of the complexity that over time is built into a combination of administrative rules, statutory changes, and I've heard someone say, well, there's been piles of changes, but I'm not convinced that those changes necessarily have brought about a system that's any less complex and any less easy to work with. And so reconciling that to is an important recommendation. And then finally, we really believe that somehow or another we need to be looking to the future. If I were to make a comment about one of the failings of Senate Bill 100 and had the pleasure of serving on that committee too, it was nice to hear the recollection earlier this morning. I'd forgotten a lot of that. I didn't realize all that happened, but you know, that's the advantage of time. But one of the things that we missed, and you see it over time, is we assumed in 73 that the act we passed then and the principles we were dealing with were going to be static, and we couldn't have been further from the truth. The facts are things change, and I think you have to build into the system a way in which you can begin to reconcile some of the pressures that change economically and otherwise over time. And so we believe that some type of a strategic planning effort is an important thing to do. We've recommended that the LCDC lead that, but it could be done in any number of ways. Mm-hmm. So those were the five basic recommendations that came forth from a legislative perspective. There are some other legislative recommendations which require more of an ongoing effort. One is a recommendation with regard to trying to improve citizen participation. We've all heard the horror stories about legal fees and appeals and process, and only people show up when there's a specific issue, and we have some recommendations with regard to that. We have a recommendation that relates to infrastructure finance. We've concluded that the Achilles heel of the future of urban growth boundaries to be effective effective in managing growth is in part, to a great extent, the failure of funding available for infrastructure. Federal programs have gone away, and so there was an interesting article in the Oregonian a couple of weeks ago with regard to some of the development, and for the lack of funding for infrastructure, the effectiveness of urban growth boundaries as a tool to deal with growth are at risk. Climate change clearly is an issue you're all dealing with. Rather than dealing specifically in the bill with a set of climate change issues that deal with the changes we're proposing, we felt that you would be better advised to try to incorporate more globally the recommendations of the Commission and others that are dealing with that question. And that was a judgment call on the part of the task force, which we felt, in the interest of trying to stay true to our mission, made more sense. And then finally, the planning for a vibrant economy, and there's some reference to that. I wish I could tell you how to make the economy more effective, particularly this day and age. There is no silver bullet, but it is, in fact, something that we believe needs to be incorporated more aggressively in land use planning. So that's a quick summary. We're at a point where I want to make a couple other comments, and then I could walk through the summary of the chapters, or we could stop there and answer questions, and I'll leave that to your call, Madam Chair. The one thing that I do want to point out is that we did, when we first started this task, as you do in a lot of your work, the first thing you do is try to find out what's going on around the state. And so we had meetings throughout the state, went to areas, we looked at particular situations, whether it was Bear Creek or in the metropolitan area, all around and in virtually every part of the state. And we came to some very interesting preliminary conclusions, which we tried to validate over time. And those are worth noting, and they're in the introductory section if you care to look at the chapter or the page that deals with the introduction. And those are that, number one, the system we have has protected farm and forest land. You can get to that conclusion when you look at what other states have done. You heard a report earlier today with regard to that. I can't tell you whether that's I can't go much further than that to just give you a straight. If you look at acres or look at some measure of size, you can say yes, we accomplished that. Secondly, I think it's fair to say, and we concluded that the urban sprawl pressures in Oregon have been better managed and controlled than in other states, and so I think you could put a check in that box and say yes from the standpoint of the goal at the time that was accomplished. And that it's pretty obvious that Oregonians support land use planning, but they also have a very strong opinion about private property rights. And therein lies sort of the crux of the issue. In fact, as we spent the 3 years working, it became so obvious that there's such a strong element of support. Two-thirds of Oregonians or so, maybe more, support the system, but a like amount or maybe even more by a fraction support private property rights. And how you reconcile those two issues, I think, going forward, is going to be the key as to whether the system will over time service as well as it has in the past. And to the extent that you can't find a relief to the pressure that creates, and that's why we went to the local level for part of the solution. To the extent that you can't find or don't initiate some way of turning people to helping you solve the problem, the task force felt at least, you put the system at risk long term. And so that's a very important point that I don't think we ought to overlook. Other points that I think are important is that the system has over time become viewed as more regulatory, and that can be addressed, I think, and I think as you deal with one of the recommendations that we have specifically with regard to some of the auditing, it makes sense. And in that same vein, over time, we've accumulated a complex mixture of statutes. Another important point, is that the system should reflect distinctive differences between high growth and low growth areas of the state. What happens in Burns and what happens in Beaverton are completely different subject matters. And I think the task force felt that you need to find a way to reconcile the fact that the pressures are different, and you need to reflect to that. Probably most interesting, you know it, but I think I need to remind you, is that the Oregon legislature is basically with regard to farm and forest land, the Planning Commission. And over time, the legislature has granted exceptions to uses in farm zones that are now 50 or more. And what that does, as an exception is granted, and I'll use a golf course as a good example, because we saw this in Malheur County. You allow a use in a farm zone that allows a golf course, and it isn't long until someone's wanting to put a house next to the golf course. And so we sort of create our own problem by allowing expanded uses that then cause people to become frustrated with the system, and they look someplace else and say, well, they could put a house there, why can't I put one by my golf course, if you will? And so I think the task force has remained somewhat silent on whether or not the authority to make changes in farm use land should rest solely with the legislature, but we just simply want to point out that it does, if not well thought out, create conflicts, and you all know how that can happen. The other points, and you can look at them, I come back again to the importance of financing and maintaining infrastructure and what that means to our ability to deal with growth. There's 11 points, and you can look at those if you care to. I think I've tried to hit the highlights. After the 49 issue, we then went into an extensive public engagement process, and from there came the recommendations that are in the bill that's before you. In the book, there are 9 chapters that deal with those recommendations. I'd be prepared to go through them quickly, or I'm prepared to stop and simply say that we're available to respond to those. I think in the summary, I've tried to cover what the flavor of them is. So, Madam Chair, I'm going to leave that to your call, and I think Representative Whitty. There was a Representative Whitty one time. Would like to add just a bit, and then we're available to respond to you and your committee.
I'd like to hear from Commissioner Whitty, and then if committee members would like Senator Thorne to go over the details, then we can ask you that question.
Fine.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Nikki Whitty. I'm a county commissioner in Coos County. And I came to the task force with some experience in being a member of a hearings body. As the Board of Commissioners sits in judgment on appeals on land use decisions, and I know Representative Callan in her previous life did the same thing. So citizen involvement was a difficult subject to deal with because we all want it better. And we talked about everything under the sun from, I even at one point was going to see if I could contract with somebody to come down and do some education just in Coos County because I think our system is so complicated that when people are passionate for or against a project, and they come to a planning commission meeting or an appeal, they don't realize that there's criteria that they must address. And when you have 200 or 300 people standing up just saying, I don't like the project, that really doesn't help get the decision made. And so hopefully you'll have some really good testimony, but it was a troubling one for us. Another one was, how could we maybe put a little common sense or a little less bureaucracy or a little more local control into the system? Because sometimes there might be an application that comes forward that would be real good for the area, but it doesn't quite fit the system. I was supportive of the ability in our bill that would allow a look back at how the resource land was zoned in the first place. There were many rural counties in Oregon that didn't have the money to do this job right. I'm sure you've heard that many times. And I've gone back and looked at our record, and I've interviewed those members of the team that put Coos County's plan together that are still alive. And there appeared to be much acceptance over the interim zones that we used during the years the plan was under discussion, and lots of hours spent actually looking at the pieces of property to put these interim zones on. But when the dust settled and most everything outside in the hinterlands, I say, had to become farmer forest, that's where it created some problems. And so I do think a look back, the ability to do a look back would help. I think the technology's there today to do a much better job. We heard from the former judge of Scott Cooper from Crook County that land use rules were based on soil type, but until when, a year ago or 6 months ago, Crook County had never had their soil type. So I don't know how they've dealt with land use applications over these years. And I guess that's all I need to
say. Prepared to
Mr. Bailey,
to your questions if you have
one or two, just a brief comment.
Madam Chair,
thank you for your service.
I just came here mainly just to support, but I had one comment that I think would make especially related to the.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Ken Bailey. I'm a member of the task force and Cherry Gore from the Dalles. Excuse me. The strategic planning piece that has been mentioned some, and the presentation by the university group, I think, point out the need. It makes it very difficult for us as a task force and you as a legislature to decide what to do when we don't know for sure what has worked and what hasn't worked and maybe some reasons why. I think that database that was referred to in the university's studies, various studies have been done, but a lot of the studies were done using different criteria and trying to match them up and getting knowledge out of them, I'm sure was difficult. And in a lot of places there was no survey done, so it wasn't there. So I think establishing a strategic plan and a monitoring system with some benchmarks that are common and keep it together can give you some information over time. Now, maybe that's not going to help you today or this session, but I think you got to look into the future, that if we're going to make bright decisions down the road, hopefully we've got better knowledge than we have today. We've got the systems, the computer, the database, and all these kinds of things that we didn't have in the early 70s that we should be able to make a lot better decisions, but we need to set those benchmarks and start recording the information so we can make bright decisions down the road, hopefully. And I think that's one of the main points I'd like to make.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Committee members, questions for the task force? A lot of information to absorb, although we did have a little bit of a head start on you. We've read your report.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you.
I was just letting you know that she had her hand up.
Representative Cowan.
Yeah, I was ahead of him. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your work. My assignment to this committee has reminded me of my years as a county commissioner, mm-hmm. Commissioner Witte, and it doesn't exactly bring back warm and fuzzy memories
no,
when we are talking about this specific issue. So I might have been drugged, kicking and screaming a little into this effort. I really appreciate all the time and energy that you folks put in on this whole process. I think what I'm struggling with the most in terms of your report and getting my brain around how-tos is the local control and the regional conceptually, and I'm still kind of working through the language of the bill. I absolutely agree with you around regional differences in our state and the need to redefine some farm and forest lands, and I think the other issue that comes up so repeatedly in those kinds of conversations is that a lot of developmental planning is also nice straight lines drawn on maps that don't necessarily match the terrain that you get when you actually try to do something. But I'm just not sure how to understand the regional planning concept. I can certainly see within counties, cities, and the unincorporated portions of the county working together. I'm cross-county. I'm having a little more trouble with that kind of concept. Could you expand on your thinking there a little bit?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
With regard to regional problem solving, we spent some time in Southern Oregon, and then we looked at Metro, and those are kind of two examples of a similar process, and concluded that there's things that could be learned. And I think when Mr. Whitman goes through the bill, sort of a line-by-line example, you'll have an opportunity to understand what we understood, and that was basically that if the regional problem, and I'm going to get to the two-county thing, which you're, I think, alluding to, in order for regional problem-solving to work, you got to define the problem first. And I think we start out in our first experiences by just saying, okay, everybody's got to get in the same room and agree on everything. And you force yourself into this unanimous consent or unanimous agreement. And sometimes that's not possible over some of the complex issues that get brought to the table. So what the task force believes is that for regional problem solving to work, you need to make sure you have a good understanding of what the problem is you're going to try to solve, and then make sure you have the right either cities, counties, or state agencies involved so that, in fact, you can conceivably come up with a solution. The old saying, a problem half a problem well defined is a problem half solved. And so that's the theory behind the language that's in the bill. Now, with regard to the issue specifically with counties, and particularly in that area dealing with farm and forest land, there is no easy way to deal with the subject. I'll be the first to say that. But here's why we recommended what we recommended. One option was to say to a county, you look at your farm and forest land, and then you come, you know, we've got a process that doesn't undermine the integrity of land use planning. As you can read in the bill, there's quite a bit of sideboards put on, and some will say we didn't do anything, so, and others said we've destroyed the world. So I guess maybe we're right someplace in between. But the point was, there were county commissioners, and you know this as well as I do, who said, you know, if the whole burden of determining some of the development rights on specific odd lots or other things that aren't zoned correctly in my county rests on my shoulders, you put a lot of pressure on us, and all you got to do is go around the state, and I don't want to overdo the Burns, Oregon, but Harney County is an interesting county. One area where we probably got more examples of some of the odd lots and uses of property that don't fit into the, say, 160-acre farm zone. And so you have conflicting uses that compete with some of the livestock operations that are in place there. So the conclusion we came to was, well, how do you protect and support those that want to deal with the problem but give some insulation to some of the challenges that they face locally? And that was the very simple reason why we ultimately went to two counties, thinking that there may well be an example someplace else, and people can see if they can't pull together their resources, and you start to diminish some of the pressures that some have suggested you will inevitably bring to the table if you isolate it so specific to a county. We did feel strongly that back in 73, the legislature probably made the right decision when it said counties should try to do the planning. We didn't want to undermine that, but we wanted to try to find a way to reinforce it and still get us to some conclusions that not only could apply there, insulate against some of the local pressure, but have more of a statewide potential for adoption and implementation. Hopefully I've described for you what the goal was. Whether the language in the bill is the right way to get there, I can't tell you for sure. That was our best guess. But understand what we're trying to do. We're trying to deal with problems that may well be the source of irritation over land use in a variety of ways that provides a little more objectivity than what might be the case in some specific local area.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay. Anything else? Representative Hanna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to each of you, but Mr. Thorne, thank you, because you were answering. But my question applies to that the two or more county piece. Did any two rural counties come to you and say, let's combine our efforts?
I can't recall of two that said it per se, but I do know as we pursued the issue there were counties, just as I answered the question to Representative Cowan, that there was a concern about the pressure that they would feel locally if in fact it was all just a county decision. So we thought there might be some merit in trying to get greater resources at the table.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow-up, Representative.
What I'm reading in Section 6 of the bill, and I know we're going to get more detailed description of how this goes, is that it really didn't change the county's ability as it applies to the designation of farm and forest land. They currently have the opportunity to go in front of LCDC and make that request.
That's right.
This just adds, if you will, from my description, the additional burden of finding another county who would go with them to do that.
For a different purpose. If they want to take a look at trying to create another designation or another sort of, shall we say, use of farm and forest land, that's the opportunity that was intended as a part of the new language that's in the bill.
I think to clarify that, maybe it does not take away the current process. So that would still remain, and if two counties got together to come up with a new definition of or tool for defining ag land, they could propose to the state that they and the state commission would then have the authority to review that or approve it or not.
Madam Chair, can we get a follow-up to that clarification?
Yes.
So what I still understand is currently counties have the option of going to LCDC for a designation of change now. They bear that burden themselves. They can go to LCDC. The way I'm reading Section 6, they would not be able to do that on their own under the recommendation or the new bill.
And they would not be able to do that at the time they would and request a new definition of ag land for their county. They'd have to go with another county. If they wanted to use the existing definition of ag land and use the current procedures,
right,
they could.
There you go.
Okay.
Yes,
Commissioner? Madam Chair and members, Jill Delano, one of the other task force members, and I were invited to speak to the, I think it's called the Oregon Planners Institute. They have a meeting once a year at the University of Oregon. And so we were talking to them about our progress on the task force and asking them to show by a show of hands different scenarios. And when we came to trying to find a definition for maybe ag and forestry land that was different than a soil type, they really seemed to be in favor of that, but they couldn't give us any ideas of what other measure might be used.
Okay, thanks. Representative Greenwood?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You obviously had a hard task and did a great job at it. I wonder, you mentioned the question of the Oregonians' great concern for their ability for the rights of private property. And I referenced two things. I referenced the Portland State study after Measure 37 that indicated that was a much more complicated, I mean, that was not a unitary perception. And I had a wonderful town hall in my district, in the rural part of my district, where about 150 people showed up at the Helvetia Tavern at 9 o'clock Saturday morning to talk about that right. And the question that I raised to my constituents was, what does it mean to you? And particularly with reference to one person saying, well, I want the right to sell my property to create a suburban subdivision here. And the guy next to them saying, well, I believe the right of private property is my right to continue farming this land the way I've been farming it for the way my family has been farming it for the last 100 years, and those rights in direct conflict with each other as they were expressed. I wonder if you had a chance, as you pondered this over what, 18 months or so, if you came away with a better understanding of what that means and how we deal with it in the land use process.
Well, I think I pointed out in response to your question, Representative, that is sort of the crux of the issue, and to the extent that you can define it clearly enough to write the solution, you've solved a lot of the problem, and I don't think we can do that. But here's what I can, I believe, tell you, that Oregonians are, on the one hand, as long as the use that they're presently putting their property to is consistent with what they want to do with it, they're probably okay. It's when something else happens that causes or makes them feel, or at least they'd plan to do something with the property and they feel like it's not been now allowed, that's when the conflict surfaces. And there's a lot of ways to approach the answer. The one piece that continues to get left out of the discussion about Senate Bill 100 was Senate Bill 101, which was the financial incentive that caused the legislature to pass the bill. Had it been a standalone without the financial incentive, I'd be willing to wager the bill wouldn't have passed. And so one of the elements of the concern, I think, gets down to sort of some fundamental issues with regard to what's mine is mine, and it has value, and it has value measured in different ways. And so that manifests itself in some kind of definition of I want to use my property the way I want to use it, whether I intended to make a profit from subdividing it or I want to just enjoy it the way it is. I don't know the answer to that. The task force didn't, I mean, we concluded you can't answer that per se, but what you can do is try to find a way for people who feel strongly about that issue to see if we can't engage them at another level in trying to find at least some acceptance or acceptable way of dealing with the problem. And that's why we finally wound up moving towards some greater reliance on some local participation. We all know the problem. So if you can make the problem someone else's, it's Salem that made me do this, or someone won't let me do this, then you can sort of take a pass on the problem. But if you have to engage yourself or you're encouraged to find the solution and be part of it, you don't get quite such an easy pass. And so in a very real practical sense, we felt that if this system is going to continue to last, it's got to find some ways to be flexible, and we got to find ways in which we can gain greater confidence at the local level. And we felt that maybe one way to do it is just simply to ask them to be a part of the solution. And so we ducked the definition that you're asking me to answer, because I don't think there's an easy answer. But we did try to open a door to say, you know, I can't answer that for you, but if you go down this road, you might help us figure out how to solve that problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're
maybe
welcome.
Just a comment on that. One of the other sides of that issue, as Mike pointed out, is placing a value on what that is. And we've suggested that there's ways in here that would provide incentives as a way of state providing or allowing more or promoting more private easements to buy easement of development rights and so forth, or transfers of development rights to develop a system to make that work to help preserve the types of things and provide value back to those that are giving up some value. And the other leg of that is what is the, how do you go about determining the proper value? The collapse of the housing market and the economy has taken a lot of the pressure off where there's what's the value of the development right on a piece of property today. You know, it's maybe totally different than it was 6 or 8 months ago. So it ways of finding out what that value is and providing tools to provide that value in or in exchange for the public benefit if it's more than what it should be.
Yes, not only does time and the economy influence it, but the construction of a freeway or a freeway off-ramp might influence it, or the location of your UGB, whether that property is inside or outside.
Some of those things come to be. You can say some are takings, so you're taking somebody's value away, but many of the values that were claimed for development right or whatever may have been more rights that were created by the land use system rather than values that were taken away. So, and the same thing, the value was created by the introduction of a major thoroughfare or freeway or whatever, there's a windfall gain. Maybe those should be taxed or whatever in order to help provide the financial mechanisms to help pay for some of the other infrastructures or pay the compensation to those that are given up rights. So there's all kinds of complications. You can get this pretty deep if you want to.
So much for our hope of simplifying this system.
Yes.
And I am mindful, Mr. Co-Chair, that you need to leave soon. I have two folks in the queue,
yeah.
And I'm sure Commissioner Witte can handle questions if you need to leave, Senator, but I want to acknowledge that we don't want
to
prevent you from catching your plane.
So yes. I don't know just in Portland that is, so that's my only concern.
Okay. All right. I have Representative Clem in the queue, and then Representative Garrett.
So, briefly, just there was another work group that worked on sort of transferable development rights and PDRs, purchases development rights, and we felt we took a cue actually from one of your recommendations that said, on top of zoning, find a way to create a system. And we have a couple bills that, mm-hmm. that I don't know where they're going to end up being assigned, but they will be heard and they will try and value that and try and figure it out. Because some of your recommendations that, you know, I really am very pleased about. I do have just one question for you that I think only you all can answer. So the sort of concept of the look back to the original zoning, I mean, there is a process to do that already. It's you can go forward and say, I'm petitioning to have my land designated a non-resource land. So I need to understand what's broken or what's wrong with that, because I own a piece of property along the Umpqua that's zoned EFU grazing, and that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1 acre. It's got a house on it. It's in a heavily forested environment. I have no idea why it would do that. Now, the fact is, I'm fine with it, though, because the house is already on it. I bought it knowing that. If it burns down, I can rebuild it. If I want to subdivide and put 4 or 5 there, and others have done this on the Umpqua, I can go, and I can prove with soil scientists that this is not grazing. Change it. I have to pay a fee, and I have to hire the scientist, but I'll likely get it changed. And so what's broken with that?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
I guess from my point of view, the problems were created by a board in our county, a board of commissioners that's long gone and a planning commission that was long gone. And I see people who try for 2 or 3 years to change the zoning on their property, just getting their application all put together to the tune of maybe somewhere. Most planning departments now, or many of them, are fee-driven. So it's gone sky high because general fund dollars just can't pay for that anymore. And so somebody pays $10,000 to $15,000 to create a wrong that was done by the local government. And to me, that isn't fair, and maybe the way around it is a direct link between the local government and DLCD and say, look, at this is wrong. You know, could we fix it without all the bureaucracy? I don't know.
So if I might follow up.
Yes.
Your proposal essentially says let's create an opportunity for a big batch of those to all come forward at once by the county without having every individual who believes theirs is miszoned pay fees, hire a soil scientist. You instead just create a batch that the county would, two counties actually, would nominate their batches of those that someone or on their own, they've come forward and said, these are all the ones we believe are miszoned. Then it goes to LCDC to say if they agree with those batches. And then on top of that, a new additional analysis is done to see if we said, yes, it's miszoned, we agree, but if you put houses there, you're going to ruin the farming operation. You add that analysis in there too, don't you?
Yeah. You would have to, because you're not doing away with the criteria that's similar on both farm and forest land. And is this going to add to fire danger, or is it going to disrupt regularly accepted farming practices? And nobody's asking that those two criteria go away.
Representative Clem, I think to be sure to point out that there's two different pieces of this process. The two counties have to go together to petition the state for a new definition that can be used in rezoning. That doesn't mean they both counties or whoever have to actually, they have to get that approved by the state before they can use it. Then at that point, any one individual county can use that to go through the process. And specifically in our new piece of it, we say that is not to be used on an individual lot-by-lot basis. It's to be used as a major area of this of the county at the minimum, or the whole county, to rezone their agricultural lands or forestry lands, and not specifically not to be used on a parcel-by-parcel basis. So it not to complicate it, but it is not as simple as saying the two counties have to do all of it together. They have to have, they are initiating the request for the new definition, but then once the state adopts that definition for that area, and that area could include more than those two counties, the state is asked to define the agricultural region to which they apply, and that could be five counties or seven counties, and then that definition could be used by the counties in that region.
I think the point that we've tried to make is I would not expect, if you adopted the language that is included in those sections 6, 7, 8, and what you're referring to, would lead to a massive batch, as you called it, of requests. There is, we're very careful in trying to set forth some criteria, as both Mr. Bailey and Ms. Whitty pointed out, and I think we ought to test that with as we go forward here to make sure that we are saying and doing what we said. Okay.
Okay. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speaking of the word complicate, one of the difficult, my difficulty with this topic is trying to reconcile the desire for more simplicity in the system, which I think, standing alone, we probably would all agree with. But there's also an interest in having a system that's responsive to local needs, that recognizes it's not one size fits all. And to me, those two values can often be in conflict. And the reason we have a long list of exceptions in the system now after 35 years is in part because people have come forward and said what works over here doesn't work over here. And so my question is, in your process, did you view these two things in terms of whether maybe there's a trade-off that we have to make? We can't necessarily have both. And if we find the value of simplicity getting in the way of local control, for example, which one of those gives way? How should this committee try and square those two things?
I don't see that. I don't think we felt that you had to give up one to the other. What the task force, I believe, is recommending to you is that notwithstanding whatever changes are made going forward, we think it's worthwhile. It would be important. It's worthwhile to go back, and I want to commend the director of the department who actually had talked with the task force about this. We think there's an opportunity to take the existing process and existing statutes and try to reconcile the complexity question. All too often there's a temptation to write a legislative proposal and say, make it more simple, and that oftentimes leads to more complexity. What we believe needs to happen is simply roll up your sleeves and start at one end and work through the other, and that's just going to take somebody that enjoys doing that kind of work and sort of, you know, flush out the things where there is inefficiencies and conflicts and rules and that sort of thing, so that you start, hopefully, with a system that is as efficient as it can be and as effective. And then as you add to it, hopefully you don't make it more complex or compound it. Pretty straightforward stuff. Just roll up your sleeves and just start at one end and work your way through and ask those questions. And that's why we didn't write a bill. We just simply believe that you ought to ask the department to do that. And I think the solution rests with a department that wants to do it. And I'm convinced that this department is willing to do that.
Anything else? Somewhat rhetorically, if I might follow up on that, we've talked about the potential conflict between local autonomy or local variations and simplicity. It seems to me, looking through the evolution of land use law in Oregon, that another conflict that has been addressed as we've amended our statutes and our rules and our goals
is that between simplicity and clarity? Because a lot of the amendments and additions have been offered in an attempt to be clearer in the expectations, which sometimes conflicts with the notion of simplicity. Because as we start to understand some of the regional differences and we start to understand more about how our agricultural economy works, you know, soils variations were a pretty good guess at trying to define it 35 years ago. That may not be the best thing. It didn't take into account access to water. It didn't take into account some of the other things. I don't know that I'm looking for an answer, but I just put it out for the committee as well, that one of the points of conflict is that between simplicity and clarity, and we will have to grapple with that as we address this bill over the next couple of weeks. Representative Wingert has the last question.
Well, a good one.
Will it produce a short answer? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not going to produce a short answer. My question is, do we need a state land use planning system? And what you're talking about and what this discussion seems to be about is the fact that there are regional differences. And the conundrum that I think that my sense of listening for days now in a number of hearings is that by running it from the state, we essentially have power centers. In this case, in this state, that's going to be Multnomah County and or the Tri-County area. And so their desires and goals really get implemented across the state. So, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is why can't we set some goals and then let either regions or climates or, you know, however you want to divide it up where it makes some sense because there's some continuity. But the idea is to get to local control. Let them figure out how to meet those goals entirely on their own. Because even by having an appeals, even by having LUBA, you're essentially creating a veto power for that power center so that when the local community makes a decision about what it wants to do, if the power center, which is outside that region, disagrees, it's vetoed and you're forced to comply. So again, my question is part of the problem here trying to have a statewide land use system rather than having regional land use systems, however you want to define that, so that it's local enough that people have the kind of input and they feel like they can buy in and they don't necessarily feel like it's being dictated from someplace that's by people or communities that are so far away they don't understand what's going on in their community. And if you could do it in like 30 seconds,
all right,
I'd appreciate it.
The task force actually looked at that question early on and concluded that you could basically let some of the preemption of federal rule and law with regard to, you know, natural areas and scenic areas and waterways and that sort of thing prevail, that you could use the court systems as a way of implementing if you had to. But as a practical matter, the task force was persuaded that there was a higher call for some of the sort of the values or the interests that Oregonians had that caused us to conclude that the system we had was probably the best way to proceed, and we've recommended some ways in which we think you could improve it to continue to make it accomplish the goals we believe Oregonians want accomplished. That's not to say that you couldn't do it someplace else, some other way. I mean, I don't want you to. I mean, ultimately, this report is now going to be yours to deal with. And just because we recommended some changes to the existing system, does that mean you couldn't write a different bill? Clearly, you could. We concluded that probably wouldn't meet with the approval of the legislature, and as we talked to Oregonians, we became more convinced that that was true. And even in rural areas, we felt, you know, that sometimes you might think they would be more or less inclined to agree that the state shouldn't do this. Interestingly enough, one of the more surprising meetings was actually a meeting in Burns when the Cattlemen's Association in particular were very defensive of the current system for some reasons that I mentioned in some of the odd lot uses. So the answer is yes to your question, why couldn't you? You could, but our recommendation didn't go there.
I think an additional comment that I'd like to make is another thing we dealt with, and I think I was leaning to a little bit, and it's been referred to here earlier today, of what is of statewide significance and what isn't. And that maybe gets a little bit to what you're... And I was leaning toward even using that sort of a thought when we started out, but you get away from it. What gets you away from it is you stop and think, what isn't of statewide concern? What isn't of statewide significance? And you look at it that way, and who are you going to leave out? Who isn't important to the state of Oregon? And what isn't important to the state of Oregon as a whole? The state of Oregon has a unique interest in all of the state of Oregon. And to say we don't have an interest in eastern Oregon or we don't have an interest in somewhere else that's not what Oregon is. So we have an interest in the whole state, and maybe we've done some things wrong or whatever, but I think the state wants to have, and that's what we heard. I think the majority, and I think I heard it from a lot of people that have objected to the current way the current system has been working, they generally like the land use system, but it's just not working the way they'd like it. They'd like it some changes made to work better for their needs. It's not throwing out the system and saying go to 100% local control deal. We've heard just as much saying we can't go there as we had say we have to go there. So where are you? But again, I get back to for myself, I look at it as trying to designate what is of statewide significance. By getting there, you have to designate something that isn't, and I had a hard time finding out what isn't.
Okay. Commissioner Whitting?
Madam Chair and members, I think to answer your question, somebody has to be in charge. And there's a bill that comes forward just about every session that would create regional LCDCs. But then you start adding the expense of taking care of those many. And our task force, I think, thought, keep what we've got because they do a good job. And then pay attention to some regional differences that make us all very unique, different parts of Oregon. And as you read our bill, and as Richard goes over it with you Thursday, pay particular attention to how we tried to be permissive in everything in this bill, because you'll find counties or cities that don't want the responsibility of taking another look, just for what Senator Thorne said. They just as soon stay out of it. So we tried to look, what could you do if you wanted to, and let people take their pick with whatever the bill looks like when it comes out?
Just out of curiosity, how many of the three of you make your living in the power center of Portland?
None. But the task force was very evenly divided, and we learned, I think, as rural folks, learned a lot about urban life, and they learned a lot about...
I have no doubt about that, and that will be the experience of this panel,
okay,
too, because we represent communities from very different parts of the state on this panel, and that's by design.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Drive carefully.
Okay.
We will see you soon. Before we adjourn, I will just call attention, colleagues, we do have another informational meeting on Thursday to flesh out the last of our perspectives on different interest groups who are users of the land use system, participants in it. That will be this Thursday. We are, as I said, looking at a public testimony hearing on this bill, probably post for next Tuesday.
Here in Salem.
The task force held 34 meetings around the state. I don't think this bill needs to get trotted around the state. We may take another bill or two that are in our committee to a location outside the Capitol, but not this one. However, we will want to have an evening meeting. We're probably looking possibly at 2 weeks from tonight. So look at your calendars. We will be in touch with you. If that works for a quorum of the committee, that's probably what we're going to be looking at.
Time?
I'm thinking probably 5 to 8. That's not on this bill. Yeah. If we do take another bill out of Salem, We might be looking at a Saturday.
Tuesday is the worst night.
But we'll be in touch with you. So with those announcements, we will be adjourned. See you on Thursday.
February 10th.